17 years of doing this show, I have recorded an episode by myself twice. Once went badly. I don't remember it, and I'm not sure if I have a recording. And I really mean I don't remember it. The second one was when KOSP shut down, and I kind of commented on the station closing. That one, okay. One-person episode, late at night, in my wood shop, in Boulder Creek, California. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is episode 29 of season 17 of Geek Speak. I'm drinking a Indian Pale Ale, Sculpin, by Blast Point Brewing Company. Blastpoint.com, bottled in San Diego, California, by Blast Point Brewing Company. So if you've got the time and you want to grab a beer, join me. I'm a volunteer. I've been volunteering pretty much all my life. And when I mean volunteer, I mean I do volunteerism like a job. My parents started a small theater company when I was six or seven, and the second show I was in as a performer. And then around 11 or so, I would say, I actually started being a person that was working the shows. And what I mean by that is I was running the soundboard or laser or special effects or doing stage crew, definitely painting and construction and pulling nails and all those things. But it was a commitment that was I took seriously. And that led me to regularly speak to my parents in a professional manner. So I'd call my father, Peter, and my mother, Diana, and of course, mom and dad as well sometimes. But in professional settings, I'd call them by their first name when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9, so on. This led to a kind of funny thing, actually, with my father. Unfortunately, his name was Peter, and so, of course, I'd say my dad in referencing him, but sometimes I'd say my Peter, and, of course, that would get a chuckle. I was referring to my father, though. As a volunteer, the job you do, like this radio show, for example, which I've been coming up on 17 years completed, it's a requirement that you do all the time, but the compensation is minimal. It's just something you decide to do. And lately, I've been kind of looking at all the things in my life I've been deciding to do and trying to figure out what things I should continue to do. I like doing things. I like creating things. I like figuring things out. I like discussing things with people. And GeekSpeak has been a pleasure of mine for years and years. You know, get to the nitty-gritty and think about it and geek out about it. The last 2 weeks, I took a vacation with my family. And during that time, we took a train from San Jose, California, up to Oregon, and another train over to Whitefish, Montana, where we got off. It took about 2 nights and a full day, and it was fantastic. Just a relaxing train ride, looking out the windows. I highly recommend it. During the train ride, there would have been, you know, network and such, but we didn't pay for it. I was trying to be a little off the grid. It was challenging, though. In any case, before that trip, I went ahead and recorded two shows and got them ready and got them in the can. And those are the last two episodes you heard. The wonderful episode with Brendan Gregg and myself talking about working at Netflix and what that was like. Really wonderful conversation with Brendan. And of course, coming back to work today, I really love that place. It's fantastic. And then, of course, last week's episode with Michael Lopp, Rans on the internets, talking about his career and such. And I had a blast chatting with Rans. And, you know, I wouldn't take the opportunity to do these wonderful discussions if it weren't for the volunteering of GeekSpeak that I do every week. So I am severely gracious and grateful to do the show. Now, I don't actually have to do a show every week if it was just a podcast, but luckily for me, and for the program, and for the community of Boulder Creek, I decided to be on the radio again. And, you know, a couple months ago, or a couple, maybe quite a while ago, we started broadcasting at KBCZ 90.1 FM Boulder Creek Community Radio. Hi, everybody in Boulder Creek. And it's been a blast to be on air, and it's been a blast to chat with people and have people recognize my voice locally in the town that I live in. But it does require me to make sure to do a show every week, even when I've been on vacation, come back and realize, oh, you know what? I got to record a show and it's 12 o'clock and at night and I got to be on air at 9 a.m. in the morning. So I better get into my wood shop and record an episode of GeekSpeak. So volunteering has its perks. Now, the other thing about this is that when you do something every single week or every day, whatever, when you do something consistently, you inevitably get better at it or fail. And I think I have been getting better at it. Interviewing people, I actually do an internal podcast at Netflix as well now. And I've realized that I definitely have grown a skill around interviewing people. And I love doing it. It is more time to set up those interviews, of course, and to then edit them. But it's been rewarding. So my intention is to do more of those kind of form. If any of my listeners that regularly work with me or listen to the show and love the show would like to assist in booking programs with me and know a little bit about that kind of thing, please do send me an email. I'm Lyle at all the places. My last name, this program, geekspeak.org, or even at Netflix. But don't email me there unless it's about Netflix work. Lyle at geekspeak.org is probably the preferred way to do it. Speaking of listeners that are awesome, we have a wonderful collection of people that are contributing a little bit of money every month to make this show happen. A few people that are contributing quite a bit of money every month to make this show happen. And that money I use for equipment, and I also use it for paying for the bandwidth, and I've been investing in marketing to spread the word of the show. So thank you all the people that are spending money donating money every month to make this program successful. I really do appreciate it quite a bit. If you'd like to learn more about that, you can go to geekspeak.org/support. But let me assure you that you don't have to give me money. In fact, it would be wonderful if you spread the word to people you think you might enjoy the show. Just let them know to look for GeekSpeak with Lyle Troxell on iTunes or wherever they get their podcasts of choice and give it a listen. I recommend last couple two episodes to anybody. So we went to Yellowstone, and it was a great trip. And we actually went to Glacier and Yellowstone and Tetons. And when we're traveling with my three children, a 15-year-old, a 12-year-old, and one who just turned 12 when we got back. And they love to be on the internets. And, you know, it makes sense. I'm a very technical, savvy person. And the other parents in their lives are also very technically savvy. And the kids have, they're the generation right now that, you know, have devices. So all three of my children have actually cell phones now, iOS devices, and also other forms of media, but they all brought their cell phones. And we kind of planned this vacation with the idea that we'd be offline. And that was kind of the intent. I didn't bring a laptop. It's the first time I've traveled without a laptop in, 15 years. And during this travel, you know, I expected to be offline. The kids, though, took advantage of a service that we've been using, which I personally love, and I want to talk about it. There are a lot of these services that allow you to do some downloads of content. We, of course, do a lot of Netflix watching, me being an employee at Netflix, and Netflix iOS device does allow you to download a lot of the content that we have rights to offer offline. You can actually go with your Netflix account and download movies and shows to your device and fill it up and then slowly play over time. And the team that did the work on that did an excellent job. So when you download a whole bunch of episodes, you know, you start playing an episode and it will continue playing to the next episode. It'll actually prompt you also like, go ahead and delete this if you want. So it's really well done. And a kudos to a whole bunch of people, but you know, Jordana and Jim, who I work with, are both big leads on that project. And they did an excellent job. A lot of people were involved, of course, and I couldn't name them all. In any case, the other downloading tool that we have as a family, our family, is Google Play Music. And we actually have a family plan that I pay, I don't know what it is, like $15 a month or so. And so a little bit more, actually, than Netflix. And the kids, of course, watch a lot of YouTube and engage in that content quite a bit. And when you do the Google Play Music family plan, you also get Google Red for all your family members. I think it's up to 5 family members. Could be more, I'm not sure. So yeah, it's kind of like, well, I mean, you don't have the commercials on YouTube, which is pretty awesome for a viewer. And as a device, when you shut the screen off and you have a playlist set up, whether it's the Play Music or YouTube videos, you can just play and they will play automatically, even when the screen is locked. It'll stop at first, but basically, it's a great thing to do if you're listening to, if you're watching YouTube content that you don't actually have to view, but you can just listen to it. And so I do that a lot, actually, with kind of my feeds of things I listen to. I do watch a lot of videos about making things. Darista and a few other makers that I follow are awesome, but you got to have view those things. So those are never locked screens. But any comedians I might want to catch up with, or musicians I might want to catch up, or the comedy shows, the nightly comedy shows, I listen to those pretty regularly. Sometimes I won't get the laugh that's, you know, a pop-up screen on the over the on the left-hand side of the screen, but most of the time, of course, you can kind of understand the joke. So I do that when doing dishes and stuff. I'll have it in my pocket and listen to that kind of stuff. Kind of fun. So not a bad thing. When you don't pay for YouTube Red, then you can't play audio files when the screen is locked. Quick knowledge here for you. Netflix does allow you to do this as well. We don't stop you from playing audio when the video is playing. But the trick here is that when you put the phone to sleep, put background mode, or push the side button on an iPhone or the top on an old iPhone, and it turns off the screen, it'll stop video playback. But if you have a Bluetooth device, audio Bluetooth device connected, or your little earbuds tethered, and you push the play button again, it will start audio again. So these are great for the comedy shows we have. If you like comedy, doing dishes and just listening instead of watching. So anyway, good plan for YouTube. I do recommend it. Not necessarily endorsing it, but if it works for you, what the heck, right? So it looks like I can have 6 people on my family plan. That's good to know. So you can as well, of course. It costs $15, $14.99 a month. So in any case, if you want to give it a shot, please feel free to do that. I won't get any kickback. It's not an ad, all that. But I've enjoyed it, so I thought you might want to know about it. Traveling and the lack of artificial intelligence. When I first set up this plan, we didn't know when we'd be in Yellowstone and when we'd be at my aunt's house in Bozeman, Montana. We did visit both. So when I booked the car service, and I actually used mostly Budget and Avis, I wasn't sure of the date when I would be in Bozeman to swap cars. I could not get a vehicle from, and bear with me, this does have to do with tech, okay? It really does. You gotta just hold on there for a second. Anyway, so I booked a car from Whitefish, Montana for a few days, and then from another city close by, and then from there to Bozeman, and from Bozeman down to Yellowstone West Yellowstone, where we then flew out of, and that was weeks later. And when setting up this plan, I wasn't sure when the Bozeman transfer time would happen. I could not get a vehicle from the east side of Montana, northeast side of Montana, to the southeast of Montana West Yellowstone, because the system online wouldn't let me do this. It just couldn't let me have one vehicle the entire time. So I ended up having 3 different vehicles, and that's fine. I kind of get there was a problem, whatever, but it did feel like, well, really, why? Why is it like this? The other intention, of course, is that when I booked it, then we started booking our rooms and all the stuff we were going to stay at, and then I knew. So then I contacted the company again. And they said, oh, you know, I can't change this now. You've paid for it, and I can't change it. This is the online service. You're going to have to talk to the company when you check out the vehicle. You can then change it. Okay, that's a little sketchy, but whatever. So I go to the little company in the east side of Montana, west side of Montana, and I tell them what's going on. And they say, oh, yeah, you prepaid, so we can't change this. So I was stuck in the situation of, because I prepaid, the local company couldn't change it, and the corporation level, the .com company, if you will, couldn't change it because they couldn't change a policy that was in place for the individual carrier. The long and the short of this is this. These corporations own vehicles, and also they have kind of satellite offices. And these satellite offices run as independent companies. And those independent companies that take advantage of this larger corporation own their own vehicles. And that independent company wants to service their vehicles and manage their vehicles and handle their vehicles and deal with the insurance and all that stuff. And so they restrict where those vehicles can go. The corporate vehicles can go anywhere. The local company vehicles cannot go anywhere. Can't go everywhere. And this completely makes sense from a lot of perspective. The corporation doesn't have to invest as much. The local company can have a better deal on their vehicles because they run them themselves. They have their own mechanics and all of that. So I could not get a car from the west side of Montana to the east side of Montana without going through Bozeman. But the truth of this is, and I really realized about this, is that this is an artificial intelligence problem more than anything else. Because clearly what's going on here is that the most important thing for that company is that every once in a while when the car needs to be serviced, it's in their shop and they can take advantage of fixing it. So at some regards, and keep in mind, the vehicle I was checking out from them could go anywhere, any mileage I wanted. I could drive to Florida and back within, you know, the 5 days or whatever that I had the vehicle. I had it longer than that. So the mileage didn't matter. But what mattered is that they wanted it every once in a while at their facility for them to work on it and to own it. So that's the trick. How do you get a whole bunch of independent companies to coordinate in such a way that the vehicles come back to them regularly? Well, you'd have to manage all the checkout staff. Because, of course, let's say I do take the vehicle and I do drop it off in, I don't know, Bozeman or West Yellowstone. I drop it off in West Yellowstone. Now, they have no office there. They're not affiliated with the office there, whatever. Now, that vehicle's in that lot and someone wants to rent a vehicle. At that point, when the person wants to rent a vehicle, they come in, they say, hey, I've got a standard vehicle. Actually, I want to upgrade to a larger vehicle, whatever. And the rep that's there has to determine which vehicle to give them. And you want to give them the flexibility because, of course, the person might go out there and come back and go, oh, no, I don't like the size of it or whatever, right? So there's some flexibility that has to happen from a human being. So they don't have in place a restriction that kind of helps assist that vehicle going back to the right location. But also the local office, of course, the human there in West Yellowstone doesn't understand the full concept of all vehicles in the area or in the surrounding five states that might need something within a certain period of time. That problem scope is too large for a human mind to handle. But it's not for an artificial intelligence kind of machine. It's not for a machine learning situation, right? Having a whole bunch of independent pieces that have to move certain ways is just a processing problem. And I know that over time, the company that invests in this effectively will have the fleet move more readily, be used more effectively, and in general, be more successful at having the vehicles rented. Anytime the company, of course, has stock, they're failing. You really want the company to have all the vehicles rented all the time. Of course, you can't do that, right? Because you have to have them maintained and cleaned and all of that. But also, you have to make sure you have the inventory you need. So it's just as I drove one day from southern part of Yellowstone up to Bozeman, dropping my family off at a hot spring so they could play while I drove, and then swapped a car at an airport in Bozeman, you know, gave them keys. It was so great. The rep was like, well, okay, do you want to take this car with you? And I was like, no, I'd love to do that, but I've just driven 3.5 hours to do this one vehicle transfer, and I assure you, you will not be able to give me that vehicle. And they couldn't. And they didn't even check, but I knew they couldn't. They gave me a different vehicle. It was fine. It was fun to try out different vehicles. But, you know, as I did this, I was completely aware that this is a moment in time problem. And of course, you know, first world problems, right? I had to drive extra time. No, it was a fantastic trip. And it was just interesting to see where these large data problems will be solved. I'm also just curious that, you know, we have seen as computer systems go forward and make decisions for us that we seem to get stuck in little circles like this, right? The local rep wanted to help me. The person on the service line wanted to help me, but they were both locked out of being able to help me because of the systems in place. Oh, here's a quick hint, though. If you are dealing with Avis and Budget, they're the same company, really, if you're dealing with them, I would highly recommend not prepaying the corporation because currently if you prepay the .com, if you put your credit card in, you actually pay for the vehicle. You will get the vehicle, which is awesome, but you also are locking yourself into a situation where you will not be able to change it very effectively. So there's a hint from Yellowstone. Okay, or from renting cars and going to Montana. Second thing, have the opportunity to do this. Do this. It was a fantastic trip. And yes, we were offline. My kids ran out of videos that they had downloaded from YouTube, and therefore they just were able to watch and enjoy. And of course, also when we're going through places where we were like, my wife and I are like amazed by the beauty. We say, okay, kids, meet it off. And they're, you know, searching for bears and elk and moose and bison. Man, there are a lot of bison. Anyway, saw all those things in the wild, and that was fantastic. Another little hint, if you go out to Montana and you're near Bozeman traveling to Yellowstone from there, there is a grizzly bear encounter place that you're like, oh, is that going to be... I recommend doing that. It's fantastic. They have about 7 bears. They're in a larger area, and they bring a few into a smaller area, and you get to see grizzlies pleasantly in their protected from you, or you protected from them, doing their thing. It's like a zoo, but it was a great experience seeing a grizzly prior to going to an environment where there were grizzlies. The other thing to do is, if you're traveling in Yellowstone, you're doing hiking and stuff, go ahead and get bear spray. Fantastic tech. Think of it as high concentration pepper spray for bears. Bears, of course, have a canine aspect to them, really good nose. They're roamers and omnivores. They'll eat anything kind of thing, potentially to nibble on you. So when you're traveling with an environment where there's bears, you want to be able to protect yourself. Shooting a bear, unless you're amazingly good at killing an animal, would just piss it off. They're extremely strong and powerful. Even a large caliber bullet won't actually kill a bear. But more than that, you wouldn't want to kill the bear. You're going in their environment. In any case, pepper spray, this bear spray, happens to work great. You have to train yourself a little bit on how to use it. We didn't have to use it. We didn't actually even get it, but we wished at one point when hiking early in the morning that we had some. The general idea is that it stinks really bad. And the great thing about this is you spray it kind of in front of the bear. It shoots a long distance, and the bear will go into the stench of the cloud, if you will, after it bounces off the ground and kind of makes a cloud around it, and they'll veer off in a different direction. But even better than that, they now recognize that a human is like a skunk, and later on, they're less likely to engage in a human. So you're basically kind of producing the effect that we're a nasty creature for a bear to encounter, which is great. Speaking of which, you know, there's a whole horrible history at Yellowstone of kind of taking advantage of nature. There was a point in time at the parks in the 40s and 50s that they would take garbage and put it in different areas. You could go and watch bears eat garbage. Of course, it's a horrible training mechanism for the bear because over time, the bear kind of expects that food and they'll come looking for it. So anytime they see a human, they'll start looking and engaging with the human. So any environment where that's happened over time, it's really dangerous for people and for bears, because if bears get really interested in humans, the bear has to be put down or moved to a place where there's no humans, which is getting more and more uncommon on this planet. In any case, when you restrict that, you stop doing that, of course, the bears generally aren't interested in you unless they're extremely hungry, hence the need for pepper spray, hungry or curious. So we learned all about that and safety in bears. More advice. I decided this time to not rate. I'll do ratings of systems and services that I use online. You know, I'll give my feedback when I think it's interesting. I'll give good ratings or bad ratings. I've kind of done the Yelp, you know, feeling like, oh, I'm getting points for adding more to the world. But I decided this time, even though we had a great experience one place and a really bad experience another place, I didn't rate either of them. I decided, you know what, you know, part of the adventure, if you will, of vacationing or traveling is to experience the different ideas and different places. And if I engage in that kind of broadly, first I'm letting everybody else know of my wisdom, but also I'm potentially taking away from the adventure aspect of it. But I want to give you one piece of advice if you're going to Yellowstone and you're going to stay in the cabins. I'm not sure about camping because we did lodges. If you're going to stay in the lodges, do not stay at Grant. Grant is one of the lodges, the newer lodges, and it's more expensive than the other ones. It has no history. It's a relatively new lodge. A lot of walking, and there's no place to hang out. Some of the other lodges, like at Lake, have these amazing old hotels with wonderful hangout areas. Big leather sofas, lots of windows of the lake, piano player, in making the room enjoyable, a bar that's quite nice and skilled. I don't know, it's just great. But Grant was not like that, so avoid Grant. There you go. And I'm not going to put that online, just on audio form, this intimate thing we called podcasting. All right, some tech news. It's time. There's some news about Facebook shutting down this AI program that was getting dangerously smart. And that was completely ridiculous, sensationalist headlines. And it ticks me off. I wish AI was getting intelligently or dangerously smart, but that's not the case. Here's some of the headlines of this story. Facebook engineers panic, pull the plug on AI after bot develops their own language. Facebook, another one writes, Facebook shuts down AI after it invents its own creepy language. Another headline, did we humans just create Frankenstein? And one other, let's say British tabloid quoted robots professor saying that the incident showed the dangers of deferring to artificial intelligence and could be lethal. If smart tech was injected into military robots. These are all referring to a project that was just a very standard kind of way of having artificial intelligence engage with itself. So the general practice that was taking place here was generative adversarial network. You basically take two programs, and they are, you know, artificial intelligence programs in the sense that they're deep learning machine language programs that can then communicate with each other, right? So you take one with a task and you give another with a task, and then you allow them to communicate, and they are adversarial in their attempt to create, come up with a solution. And the task that they were given to basically was just two agents. They were trying to negotiate with each other about a collection of items. So there's a whole bunch of items, and the two were negotiating to figure out who would get what item. Okay. And they were started with English as their communication mechanism to determine what they're going to get. So let's say you had 15 potatoes and 20 flashlights, and both AIs knew what the prices were, and they had to negotiate basically which one would walk away with which amount. Okay. This is just kind of basic economics in some way, right? And the system was set up to do English and to communicate with each other, but there wasn't a restriction to always keep the communication in English. And so over time, the system that we're just basically trying to say, well, I want this much, and you want this much, and I want this much, and you want this much, we're using English with an understanding that they didn't have to do that. They just had to communicate their intent. And over time, their intent was passed with non-English. So here is a bit of the dialogue they were using. The two computers were Bob and Alice, and the reason for that is A, B, computer A, computer B, Alice and Bob. So Bob, this is going to be a little hard to read because it's not English. I everything else, Alice. Balls have zero to me, 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 to. Bob, you, I, everything else, Alice. Balls have a ball to me, to me, to me, to me, to me, to me, to me. Now, it sounds like gibberish, and it goes on like that. It sounds like everything else. It sounds like gibberish, but what's actually happening here is as they communicate over and over and over again and learn the understand the, and agree to understand things, they can communicate more and more abruptly and intelligently. And I say intelligently, minimalistically. And this would happen if you and I were communicating too. If you and I were talking about, well, I want to go to the river and I want to bring these four bags of paperwork and I might also want to go do this other thing. And you're like, oh, I want to go to the river too, but I'm actually planning on collecting these items. Over a period of conversation of like 20 minutes, we'd be really bored of the conversation. But at that point, we would both know a little bit about what the other person wanted. And the way we were communicating would probably be more minimalistic. We probably would never say river anymore, you know, because we both agreed early on that we're going down to the river. So we'd never say, I want to bring this stuff to the river. We just say, I want to bring this stuff. We'd infer some meaning that we'd already appreciated over time was part of the general understanding. And that's what these systems are doing. It's just that they're never deviating back to English. They don't have to, because as they grow their understanding, they can make more and more shortcuts. So the programmers did shut it off because they were more interested in what was actually being done, and they can't understand that dialogue. They have to put that in the dialogue back in English. So they turned off the program so that they could set it up to restrict them to proper English such that the program would actually have the running project, the research project, would actually come up with a final conclusion that would be meaningful. So that's the Facebook story that you might have heard about, machines learning a new language and communicating with a language we didn't understand. You're listening to Geek Speak, and this is KBCZ, Boulder Creek Community Radio, 90.1 FM. And FM, of course, stands for... I'm Lyle Troxell. You can ask me questions, answer things I might ask you, and generally find out more about our program up at geekspeak.org. And of course, if you'd like to contribute to the program, please do so by letting your friends know about us. Love to spread the word. That's right. FM stands for frequency modulation. I should probably define those two things, but I won't. Instead, let me tell you about Apple. Here's another kind of sensationalistic story that I saw this week. And here's the title. Apple signals it's willing to let next-gen web apps compete with iOS apps. And that's from The Register. Now, I say this is sensational because, well, I don't think that's what they're signaling. I mean, sure, it's true that there was complaints about this one feature not being in the web service, web browser, in Safari, or actually the iOS platform, the browser in there is actually Safari. There was a W3C, which is the World Wide Web Consortium, specification or proposal specification, I don't think it's even been ratified, that allows for a certain feature to exist in browsers, and all the other browsers are actually using this feature. And when I say all the other browsers are using this feature, Firefox has got it, Chrome has got it, Opera has got it, Chrome for Android has got it. So Safari wasn't doing it, Apple wasn't doing it, it was a little annoying. So they basically recently said, we will start using this feature. This feature is called Service Workers. And there's a complaint about them not doing it, and then the WebKit developers said, okay, yeah, we're going to put it in. And Service Worker is kind of an interesting idea. Generally, when you think of a web page, you start up a web page, and what's actually happening is your browser is connected to the server, and the server is responding with some data, and as soon as it responds with that data, the application starts running, the JavaScript starts running, the CSS, the HTML, and you get a web page. And as you have that browser open and your internet connection is running, things are happening. A good example of a really high-end application like this is Gmail. If you go log into Gmail and you're using Gmail, actually, if I send you email while you have the web page open, the email will show up in the window. That's happening because there's actually communication to the server back and forth all the time. Another example of a good application that's, you know, complex is the Netflix web browser application. If you log into Netflix with Chrome or whatever, or Safari or Opera, whatever these apps I was talking about, you get an application which allows you to kind of view and experience Netflix and add to your list and all those things. So these applications traditionally run when you intend them to run and when you're online. And when they're not, when you're not online or you don't have them open, not so much. However, service workers allow, and here's the description, a similar description of what a service worker is. It's a method that enables applications to take advantage of persistent background processing, including hooks to enable bootstrapping of web applications while offline. So what this effectively means is even you have basically this application execution thread that can happen in without the UI being a big part of the run. It's a little confusing to think about, but think of it as like a background thread or background task occurring for you while you're not using it. And the reason why this journalist at The Register kind of referenced it competing with iOS apps is that iOS apps do this all the time. If you've installed something like a Facebook app on your phone and you have your phone off, every once in a while you'll get a notification. And that notification fires through and says, hey, this is what's going on. And that can occur because there's a system in place that's working in the background all the time, the notification engine of iOS. And so what actually occurred is Facebook told Apple, hey, I want to notify this user. And Apple then said, yeah, you've got enough priorities and sent a message down to the phone and part of the handshaking of the phone. And the phone then sent this message up saying, Facebook wants to talk to you. When that actually occurs, when that notification occurs on the iOS, the Facebook application is actually notified that the notification came through. And then the Facebook application on your phone in the background, when you don't have it open, then executes this little window. And it can do different things like show you an image or show you whatever. And also then when you actually activate the notification, you can execute things with that as well. To learn more about this, you can learn about the notification system on iOS. Pretty much all the docs are available at developer.apple.com. But I digress. The point of this is that that's what service workers are kind of for. There's kind of execution in the background, but for web pages. And you would need that kind of thing to produce this kind of notification system. Apple is not allowing web applications to receive notifications at all, but they're making one little step, one little inroad. As a person that strongly believes in the open web, please see previous episodes about the open web of GeekSpeak and across the internet, I firmly believe that it's nice to have the kind of extended feature sets available to all applications in all spaces. Even though I'm a full-time iOS developer, I still believe that having strong open web is actually the better way to deal with growth and innovation. If you have companies controlling all the innovation on device, that's a failure. That's why we need to have the open web function well. So kudos to Apple planning to add service workers to their system. Now, you might be wondering, how did I know what service workers, that feature, was enabled? What browsers are enabled? I was able to read them off pretty quickly. Well, I use a site called Can I Use. If you are a web developer at all, you must use caniuse.com. All the features that the WW3C, CSS, JavaScript, browser support of different features, all those exist in kind of a highlighted chart by type at caniuse.com. It's great for a web development. And from there, you can learn more about all the different techs. So it's kind of fun to browse and see, oh, wow, this feature is available everywhere. Another feature that actually kind of came across my eyes this week was, well, not really eyes. I ran to a video about this, and it's CSS grid layout. When you're laying out web pages, traditionally what you do is there's a lot of methodologies for doing web design layout, and I know this is getting technical, and bear with me. Let me have a piece of chocolate. So I mentioned the beer at the beginning of this show that I'm enjoying right now. Of course, for me, it's nighttime, so that's okay. If it's the morning for you, don't enjoy the beer, but please feel free to enjoy the chocolate. I am having some strong dark chocolate by Choco Love. XOXOXO. It's a dark chocolate. It's 70% cocoa content. I'm a low carb person. I eat a lot of protein. I kind of try to keep myself in ketosis, though I didn't do such a great job on this vacation. And this lovely chocolate is pretty good on the carb situation. Let's see. It's 14 carbs per serving. That's pretty much all my carbs for the day, but I've been pretty good this week. Of course, I'm having a beer as well, so maybe I'm cheating way too much. Anyway, this is from Boulder, Colorado. Choco Love. And I bought it in San Lorenzo Valley, I'm sure. Probably at New Leaf. And it is dark chocolate and delicious. So CSS grid layout. The different ways of traditional of doing this kind of technical way of designing web pages. You have to tell in code the browser how to render a certain look you might want to do. And there are traditionally very challenging things to do. Early on, before we had cascading style sheets, which is what CSS stands for, we had HTML. And HTML, hypertext markup language, that's the language de franca of the web. Web is all HTML at its core, and then other things on top of that. Hypertext markup language allows you to do things like, I want a headline, and I want a link, and I want a division or a paragraph. And there's these different terms that actually, when you say in the document, I want a paragraph, it very specifically does something. It puts the text such that there's space at the top, a space on the bottom. And every paragraph tag that you put in there does that. It automatically adds spacing. And when you know what you were typing with a typewriter, you do a carriage return and you have a certain amount of space, and the typewriter kind of defined that. In HTML world, it was kind of defined for you. And there were ways of changing things, like the font and things of that nature, but the restriction set was relatively limited. So if you wanted to have more of a spacing between paragraphs than than the system was doing for you automatically, in the early days, you would do a trick. You would make a transparent image, a GIF, and you'd say to put that transparent image after the paragraph one, before paragraph two, and you'd make that transparent image 34 pixels high, whatever, right? And because there was an image there, and the web browser would actually render images the correct size, even though the image was transparent and you couldn't see it was there, it would push the paragraph, the second paragraph, down a little bit more, increasing the size. There are tons of tricks like this. The transparent GIF, the one pixel transparent GIF, the reason why it was one pixel is that you didn't want to download this thing. You wanted it to be very quick. So you made it one pixel, very small file, one bit. Well, bigger than that, one byte. Sorry. Actually, it had headers and all. I mean, it had more information in it, but in any case, it was a very small file. But you could tell the browser to render it in a different way. You could make it any size you wanted, and that allowed you to, you know, use one pixel but spread it really wide and do padding. That is how, in the early web, when I started, we did spacing. We handled all of our spacing using a thing called spacer.gif. It was an image that was just that for that purpose. Later on, if you want to draw a box around something, you want to have a thin black line around something, there was another HTML courtesy, which is called a table. And this is just like an Excel table, right? A spreadsheet type of thing. And it really was for giving tabular information. So in the early days, what you could do is you could actually set up a table such that you had very thin cells around everything you wanted, and in that cell you would put an image of one pixel and you'd have that size, and then you'd make the background of that cell a color, and in doing that you would draw boxes. And I have to tell you, I did a lot of drawing boxes using that kind of code. And when you look at the HTML of that, it's disgusting. It's very complicated and complex. And I was doing this stuff by hand prior to them being like really ways of doing this on the server side. At this point, it'd be actually really fun to do that same kind of thing using something like Node and building a library for yourself to build these tables. But luckily, we're saved by all that by cascading style sheets. And cascading style sheets allowed you to do things like put a border around a paragraph. And it was very simple to do. You just would say, all the paragraph tags in this document, I want a border. And you'd say, one pixel black solid. And that meant that you'd have one pixel black solid all around the thing. And you could also say border top and give it a different color, red, two pixels dashed, and it wouldn't be a solid line, it would be a dashed line. So all this kind of rich drawing capabilities for kind of general layout stuff of text started being added into the system through cascading style sheets that's been extended over the years with lots of different features. But one thing that we have lacked the entire time is an actually good layout methodology. I mean, there's been some great stuff, floating things from left and right. So you take two paragraphs, and let's say you want to just do a traditional newspaper column, right, where you have a column on the left and a column on the right. You could take that and make them both divisions or divs, and you could say, take this div and say it's 150 pixels, and it is float left, and then you could take the next div that has the next, and you say 150 pixels, and it's float right. And now what these things will do will actually both be float left if the width is right. They're going to line up to each other, and the tops of them will be the same height, and there'll be columns next to each other. It's perfectly what you want. But the truth is, it's a little strange to have your layout be in this form, because what you're doing is you're saying the document comes from the top to the bottom, and as I'm reading along, depending on where I put the text and how I float things, it's going to align a certain way. And this gets a little more complicated and complex when you want to do things like have both your columns be the same height. Not very easy to do traditionally so. Also, it became more complicated because we started having mobile devices. And mobile devices, of course, have a very different screen size. And if I gave you a web page that worked on a mobile device and the same web page worked on a browser on a laptop, one of them wouldn't look good because they're just such a different size. And so other features were set up. We do things like layout engines that actually use JavaScript to rewrite the HTML in the page. That's a mess, and it's kind of a silly thing to do with JavaScript, even if you can do it. It'd be much better to do with CSS. So we came up with a thing called Flexbox, and Flexbox, fantastic. It beat the heck out of floats and clears and clear all to do the same kind of thing. Flexbox allows you basically to say, I want this many boxes and I want them to expand or contract and I want them to be next to each other and I want them to be this percentage. So it had a lot of great features. but you were still restricted on the way you wrote the document to where they would come out. The new methodology is called CSS Grid Layout. It's now fully supported in all current browsers, and it relatively nicely degrades. And the best way to do that is to kind of think of the app, the browser you're making, as a mobile-first design, and then extend it to look better and better using CSS Grid Layout. So in any case, it's available everywhere, and if you're doing web development, I highly recommend that you take a look at it. I've linked a really wonderful article of YouTube video explaining, it's been an hour long, explaining Grid Layout by Rachel Andrew. She's kind of the woman, that the developer that really fought for this to exist for a long time, so she's really expert at it. Here's the general idea. You say on your page, I want a grid. And you say that the layouts of the grid, the horizontal and vertical lines of the grid. And you can just imagine that as a grid, right? A straight lines. And you can set those up to any ratios you want. Then any one cell of that grid or collection of that of those cells, you can name them. And at any point, you can specify any content you want in your page to go into those named grid areas. So now the layout happens first, and you assign with CSS where the content goes from the document itself into the layout. It completely reverses the way we've traditionally done CSS and HTML layout, and I kind of wish I was a full-time web developer right now, because I would love to use this to make awesome things. And I'm sure my next run at the GeekSpeak website, I will be using a lot of CSS grid layout. I recently had some wonderful feedback from a listener that asked to calm down on the political content. Basically, long-term listener that said we were getting a little too political. You know, and I get it. We have been doing more politics than a tech show normally has been doing over the years. And I just have to say that that might happen. I am interested in a lot of things. Politics has been engaging for me recently. But I do understand that you listen to this show because we talk about technology, and I will continue to do so. Here's a story that actually is a little political and a little bit about tech. Mark Zuckerberg has pledged to remove violent threats from Facebook, triggered by the Charlottesville incidents. And I think that's kind of interesting. Facebook's been pretty bad about removing some things and pretty crazy about removing other things. Good examples over the time have been like, you know, pulling down images of women breastfeeding, right? Because the breast is exposed. And at the same time, being okay and not taking down something like a rape threat, right? Like really odd lines. And this, of course, is an extremely challenging problem. So I don't blame Facebook for this. It's not an easy thing to figure out effectively, but more so, it's not an easy thing to code, to codify, because the understanding of what is appropriate and what's not appropriate is extremely complicated, and it takes a human being, and many human beings will argue the point. One point I want to make, though, that's, I think, pretty strong, is that Facebook is a private company, and whatever it decides to do on its service does not affect free speech. It is true that we have this problem where most communication is happening online, and a lot of that communication is happening on Facebook. And as Facebook decides to silence some and not silence others, they are kind of contributing to the ability for those people to communicate effectively. And I get it. And at the same time, they are still a private company. At some point, maybe we want to say something about this from a legal standpoint, about what has to be treated as free speech, even on public services like this, even though they're a company, because there's so much control of how we communicate. But I digress. Basically, Facebook's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, broke his silence regarding the violent attacks in Charlottesville, Virginia, this past weekend, and the ongoing conversation around hosting hate groups online. In a message posted on Facebook, Zuckerberg said that the company is watching the situation closely and will take down threats of physical harm, noticing that more neo-Nazis and white supremacist rallies are planned. He says, "We won't always be perfect, but you have my commitment that we'll keep working to make Facebook a place where everyone can feel safe." And Zuckerberg wrote a letter on a more strongly worded tone than he normally has. And he said, "It's a disgrace that we still need to say that neo-Nazis and white supremacists are wrong, as if this is somehow not obvious." So it looks like they're going to redouble their efforts to remove hate groups from Facebook, which I think is a good thing for him to say, and clearly a strong statement. Cloudflare CEO also said recently that he decided, and this is an interesting kind of corollary. CloudFront is a hosting service that hosts virtual private networks or virtual machines. Basically, it's been really clear that Cloudflare has been really pro free speech. So CEO Matthew Pierce stood firm, insisting in 2013 that even though these groups that were using his service to host their sites were actually terrorist groups, he said, "A website is speech, it's not a bomb." And they basically stood strongly by supporting a customer, buying service from them, and hosting whatever they wanted, saying, you know, we don't care what the customer's doing. All it is free speech, so it's fine. But just recently, they took down a neo-Nazi site called the Daily Stormer. He just basically canceled them as a customer one day. And here's in defending what he did, this is what he said. "My rationale for making this decision was simple. The people behind the Daily Stormer are assholes. And I'd had enough." Price wrote, "Let me be clear. This was an arbitrary decision." I love that aspect that he's like, "Let me be really clear. This is not policy. I'm not changing things. This is just completely arbitrary. I don't like these people." Anyway, I think that's kind of neat seeing a human come out of a corporation and make a stance like that. Well, we're still seeing a lot of bad ransomware. And of course, ransomware is software that takes over some of your data. And the traditional pattern right now is it encrypts your data with hard encryption and then sends you a note saying, "Hey, if you want your data back, pay us and we'll give you the encryption keys." Most of the time, if you pay, they will give you the encryption keys and they'll unlock your data. And that's kind of good. They don't want to poison their own customer service. We've seen them take over hospitals and had hospitals pay, you know, $10,000, $20,000. We've seen them hit police departments and police departments having to pay, you know, $30,000, $40,000. These are really severe attacks and very effective. And this all relies, of course, on the vulnerabilities that exist in every computer system and businesses that rely on their data. A very good defense to this, of course, is general security, but also having really clean backups so that you can restore stuff again if it gets encrypted. And so I highly recommend you to, for your personal use, because this hits individuals as well, definitely have backups of your data, and don't just have a one backup. You've got to have a durational backup, because it's very possible that the encryption system of the ransomware will occur on your machine, and as it's going, all that will get backed up, overwriting stuff in your backup. So if you have a backup service that has, you know, weeks of versions of your stuff, you can step back in time to get your data back. That's a good way to go. You can also use dependent services for your documents that can't really be encrypted. And things like, if, you know, for all your documents that are text-based, you could be using something like Google Drive and Google Docs. And those can't be encrypted because they're actually a web service that holds the data. And then a photo service, something like Google Photos or iCloud Photos, or the one that I actually pay money for every week or every month and actually really love, is called SmugMug. And if you would like to, SmugMug is a kind of photo sharing service. If you want to look at my photos, they're at pix.lyle.troxel.com, pix.lyle.troxel.com. Anyway, that is my photo sharing system. And those can't be encrypted because, of course, they're also photos and they have to be upgraded in there. As they're uploaded, they're confirmed their photos by the system. So those things, those kind of services are really beneficial. A backup service with multiple stage backups is really essential to fight this ransomware. Okay, Petya ransomware could cost the large corporation container ship company. So, you know, you can think of a hospital or a police department has a certain amount of money, but a container ship company that deals with shipping things across the globe in these giant container ships obviously has a lot of money. and it looks like they've been hit by ransomware. In June, cyber attack that paralyzed the computer systems in companies around the world is estimated to have cost the world's biggest container ship line between $200 million and $300 million U.S. dollars, the AP Mueller Masaryk said Wednesday. So, Associated Press is covering the story, and basically, I mean, you know the story just from the headline. But in the last week, of the quarter, this is a quote from the CEO, Soren Skua, said, "In the last week of the quarter, we were hit by a cyber attack which mainly impacted Maersk Line, APM Terminus, and Damco businesses. Volumes were negatively affected for a couple of weeks in July. And the businesses were significantly affected, but there was no data breach or data loss." Now, I tend to think that that's him trying to claim something he can't claim. At the same time, it is highly likely that no data was breached or lost. Getting software to run on a system and actually encrypt the data locally is actually a lot easier than getting into the system and transferring the data. Because if you have a lot of data and you transfer it, you have to have a target location to put it. And that target location to put it, actually, if you have control of that system, then that means there's a kind of a way for you to get access to it. So a ransomware package is really clever. It's very much like a Trojan horse in the traditional sense. You know, you give the thing to somebody, and then it just does its thing. It doesn't do, actually, I guess the Trojan horse is a bad analogy, because the Trojans actually, of course, killed some guards and then opened the gates, and then the army came in. So I shouldn't say the Trojans, it was the Trojan horse, so the army that was in the Trojan horse. In any case, the methodology of a ransomware system is it's a very small bit of software that has a capability of slowly working on your system to encrypt all your files. If instead you have a paradigm where you steal the data, meaning you take all the files off their system and erase them and say, "I want to give them back to you," that whole thing means you've got to have a place to put it, then you have to have a place to allow the customer to then go get the data. When I say customer, victim, to go get the data from that system to put it back on. So obviously, it is actually trickier to get the data. And so it's probably valid. The CEO says there's no data breach or data loss. At the same time, it made a loss of $264 million in the second quarter against a profit of $118 million a year earlier. So obviously, not such a good situation. Revenue rose to $9.6 billion from $8.7 billion that same period. So they're making money. I'm not crying for them. At the same time, it just shows the general risk a company is at this day and age for ransomware and making sure the system is secure. It's interesting for how long vulnerabilities in security systems were interesting, but not dangerous at the same level they are now. Now they are financially motivated and highly dangerous for a company. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like as long as you give us credit. My name is Lyle Troxell, and I love doing this program. If you love it as well, please do visit us at geekspeak.org/support to give us some support financially. Or, and I do urge you to do this, give us a review on iTunes. You hear it all the time on podcasts. Or tell your friends. You can tweet about us. You can let people know. Just tell them to look for GeekSpeak with Lyle Troxell on iTunes or their podcasting service of choice. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. This has been episode 29 of season 17 of GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.